Ahora luchamos por una mejor sanidad, seguridad y educación.
Nosotros somos los gatos.
Auch nach Auflösung der Demonstration gehen die Krawalle weiter.
Se vienen días decisivos en el caso Bombas.
Frequenz.
Frequenz. Frequenz. Frequenz.
Mitschnitte.
Heute und hier gibt es einen englischsprachigen Mitschnitt einer Veranstaltung, in der ein Mitglied des Crime Thing Ex-Workers Collective die Aufstände der vergangenen Zeit kurz benennt, einordnet und analysiert, um im Anschluss anhand von drei Kernthemen
Polizei, Staatsbürgerinnenschaft und Demokratie
Anregungen zu geben, was AnarchistInnen in aufständischen Situationen beitragen können. Aber wir wollen euch nicht zu viel verraten. Hört euch lieber das Original an.
Viel Spaß.
Hello, my name is Nikita, and I come from a country far away called the United States. You might have heard of it. It's not a big deal, but one of the problems about the country where I live is that our education system is shit. So, unfortunately, I don't know any German at all. I'm really sorry, but I will be speaking in English. And I hope that it will be easy enough to understand. But at any point, if you want me to slow down or say something again, get some translation from a friend, then please just let me know and I can take a break. So, I come from the Crime Think Ex-Workers Collective, which is a group of maniacs who have been trying for years to figure out how to live more passionate and joyful lives, and have decided, for whatever crazy reasons, that participating in anarchist resistance around the world is the best way we can think of to do that. We also take time to write about our experiences and connect with comrades in many other countries to ask them about what's been happening in the struggles where they live. And so, tonight I want to take a little bit of your time to talk about some of the revolts that have been happening around the world over the last 3 years or so, and some of the conclusions that we've drawn from hearing from different people involved in these struggles, and some ideas about where to find the radical possibilities inside of these revolts. So, let's get started. Can everyone hear me okay? Great. I'm sorry that you have to see so much of my back. I'll try to turn around. All right. We have a special high-tech demonstration involving this light-up globe. It's very exciting. You may have noticed, if you've been paying attention to the news the last 3 years, the whole world is exploding with rebellions. Starting in North Africa with Egypt and Tunisia and the Arab Spring. And then spreading to the Occupy movement in the United States. The student strikes in Montreal, Canada. And then, of course, the occupations of the plazas in Spain. And then after that, the rebellions in Turkey, starting in Istanbul and spreading around the country. And then again, just a month later, erupting in Brazil with strikes and demonstrations all over the country. More recently, we've had some uprisings and occupations in... It's upside down, I can't see. In Bulgaria and in Slovenia. And most recently, of course, the revolution in Ukraine and the uprisings in Bosnia. There have also been revolts, but not necessarily revolts like we would think in Thailand and also in Venezuela, where the political content is a lot different. So we have to ask ourselves, why? Why right now? What is it about the world today that is leading to so many riots, rebellions, uprisings? Well, for one reason, because capitalism is in crisis. Capitalism is a crisis. It's a crisis for the vast majority of the world's poor, who are becoming more and more desperate as the economy grinds on. It's a crisis for the earth, for the ecosystems that make it possible for anyone to live. It's a crisis even in the wealthier countries, where austerity projects and government cuts are taking away even those compromises from the 20th century that preserved some kind of peace between capitalists and workers. It's a crisis for women, where in many of these austerity cuts, the people hit the hardest are women who lose jobs protected by the state and are expected to pick up more of the economic slack in unpaid labor, with raising children, with caring for households, and who are targeted by the forms of nationalism that police gender in harsher and harsher ways in times of crisis. And also, the social movements of the 20th century, the models that we have for how we would make revolution, are not working today in the ways that we expected that they would. This old idea that we would begin from our workplaces, in the factories, in the universities, and build unions and large organizations that would join together in a broad left that would win small reforms and little victories to build step by step towards revolution. This is not the model that we see today in these riots and rebellions around the world. We're seeing new patterns of struggle, groups of people participating who were never the traditional revolutionary subjects, people who've never been politically involved before. We see riots and rebellions starting in many different social groups, sparked by many different issues. And in spite of all of these different circumstances, different histories, different issues, there's a few patterns that we can see between most of these different rebellions. Do y'all want to come in? Ken, if you need. Okay. One pattern that we see is we see the use of tactics that look like the tactics of radical and revolutionary protests. We're not just seeing marches and demonstrations and begging politicians. We're seeing fighting in the streets, attacking police, occupying buildings, burning them down, blockading cities, shutting down the economy. And we're seeing this all over in a wide variety of struggles. But not everyone who is using these supposedly radical tactics are doing so to fight for liberation. If we look at Thailand, we see an opposition movement blockading the streets, occupying public space, in order to create a new government appointed by the king. In Venezuela, We see people putting on black masks and throwing Molotov cocktails at police to fight for a more neoliberal government. So just because we see radical tactics being used in these revolts doesn't mean that we necessarily have affinity with these struggles. Another pattern that we see, this sense of conflict, this sense of antagonism with the larger society, with the state, with the economy, this is becoming more and more general. It's not just starting from one social group or one economic class or one subculture or one industry. This sense of conflict is spreading through larger and larger parts of society. And the numbers of people who appear in the streets are massive and include all sorts of groups of people who were never political in the traditional ways before. But, again, the contradiction. When we come into the streets to protest, to participate in these rebellions, we find ourselves next to people who are not necessarily our allies. In fact, many of the people in the streets next to us may be holding us back from our own struggles. If we look at Ukraine, where nationalists doing security for the Euromaidan prevented anarchists and feminists from joining the demonstrations under their own banners. So even in a situation of general antagonism to the state or to society, we aren't necessarily finding ourselves with new allies among all of the people in the streets. Another pattern, also with a contradiction. The speed of change inside of these revolts is getting faster and faster. Where, unlike the traditional social movements that built slowly and worked for small reforms, we see revolutionary possibilities opening up almost overnight. Windows of possibility that appear seemingly out of nowhere and change our sense of what is possible in just a few weeks, just a few days. Of course, these rebellions don't come from nowhere. There's many years of organizing and relationships underneath them. But our imagination of what's possible can change incredibly quickly. But just as quickly as these new possibilities open up, they close again. And the same old power relationships, those same hierarchies, close back in on these situations, on these societies. If we look at the Occupy movement back home where I live in the United States, in September 2011, there was one occupation in New York City. 6 weeks later, by the end of October, there were over 300 occupations all over the country and spreading around the world, where nobody could have imagined a social movement like that just weeks earlier. Then, just a couple of months later, by that spring, there were none. No active occupations left. So the pace of change is becoming faster and faster, but then the pace of that change closing again is happening just as fast. So if this is our situation, if these are some of the patterns inside these rebellions, where can we find the radical possibilities? How can we participate in a way that could free up new potential? Well, since I come from an anarchist collective that looks at things in terms of a struggle against all forms of hierarchy, the question that I want to ask is, what can anarchism offer to these rebellions? What contribution can anarchism make to revolts happening in so many different countries? And to be clear, I'm not just talking about the group of people who calls themselves anarchists, the group of people who carries the black flag. This group of people has been very important in some of these uprisings, but I mean something a little bit broader than that. I'm talking about, first, a set of tactics, ways of fighting, a set of practices that spread out power rather than concentrating it in one group or one institution. And I'm also talking about a vision, an analysis of an entire world based on that spreading out of power, based on preventing power from concentrating in any one institution or group. As we see in the patterns of the use of tactics, tactics alone are not enough. Tactics alone don't necessarily have the radical content, the radical possibility that we want. But combining tactics that spread out power with that vision and that analysis, this is what I'm talking about when I ask what anarchism could contribute. And this isn't just a contribution for a small group of people who call themselves anarchists, but ways of thinking and ways of fighting that can be contagious, that anyone can use, that can spread power out in many different contexts. So, to answer this question, I want to look at three different lenses or three different themes for thinking about these different revolts. Each one can give us some insight into where radical possibilities might be found. The first theme is policing. The second theme, citizenship. And the third theme is democracy. Policing, citizenship, and democracy. Three very different systems, different concepts, but each one can offer us a window into where we could participate to open up radical possibility in these very different contexts. So, number one, policing. There's one more theme that I didn't mention that connects almost all of these different rebellions, and that is this. Every one of these revolts begins as a small local struggle, but explodes into a nationwide rebellion when popular anger against the police sparks a revolutionary attitude. For whatever reason, it seems like this is the spark in almost every one of these different revolts. This anger against the police and their violence is a spark that makes local struggles become general rebellions. If we look at Egypt, overthrowing Mubarak began from the January 25th movement, a movement against police brutality. In the United States, a bunch of strange people in tents in a park in New York City, who cares? But when the images of the police attacking these protesters in the park spread around the country, people got angry. People started to connect their own anger and alienation to that of those protesters in New York. And within weeks, hundreds of occupations appeared. Similar things happened in Turkey, where the picture of the woman in the red dress being pepper sprayed by the police created an anger across Turkey that led to demonstrations in dozens of cities within a week. Similar in Brazil, even in Ukraine, where a small, mostly liberal protest movement of university students and other activists became a popular rebellion and then an armed insurrection against the state. When this anger against police brutality connected so many different people. So why? Why is this the spark? Why is it this rage against policing that in so many different circumstances is sparking massive rebellion? Well, one reason is that in a situation of crisis, when more and more people around the world are precarious, with no stable place in the economy, no hope for the promises of the compromises of the 20th century, when states seem more and more corrupt and out of touch, when the institutions of society seem less and less legitimate, it requires more and more force to hold society together. And that force is the police and their surveillance and their violence. Another reason is that the police are the enemy that we can see. If I work at a factory and my boss moves the factory across the world to a place where labor is cheaper, and I lose my job, I probably won't see that boss or the owners of the machines in my everyday life. But I will see the police who lock the door, who kick me out, who evict me from my home when I can't pay my rent anymore. If I live in a neighborhood that gets torn down to build condos for the rich, I probably won't see the developer or the investors who paid for it, but I will see the police who evict me, who shoot tear gas at me when I protest. So police put a face to these global systems of exploitation that can seem very abstract and far away until they hit us in our everyday life. And another reason why policing is the spark that ignites nationwide rebellions is because this anger connects groups in society who previously didn't feel like they had that much in common in their struggles. In Brazil, when the protests last June grew larger and larger, and university students in the middle class began to participate in huge numbers, these protesters were outraged when the police would attack them. They would say, "Why are you attacking us? You're supposed to be here to protect us. We are Brazil. How dare you?" But the protesters from the favelas, from the poorest parts of the cities, who had felt that violence, many of them their entire lives, they didn't have this illusion, ever, that the police were there to protect them. But all of a sudden, in the streets, these different groups, who didn't feel like they had common interests and common struggles before, came together with this shared anger, this shared experience in their bodies of repression, of violence from the police. So, we usually think about police and violence as a limit on our struggles, something that holds us back from the possibilities of what actions we can take and how far we can go. And of course, this is true in the long term. Repression works. It frightens us. It takes our resources. It puts a limit on our struggles. But if we look at how policing and anger against police provides a spark for rebellions to grow all across the world in the last years, then we can also see in the short term police repression as something that creates new possibilities for connection, that can expand struggles. The limit for us comes when this popular anger is directed not against the entire institution of police, but against a particular government that's giving the orders, or a few police who are especially violent. When the focus is on whatever government is in power, or a couple of individuals, and not on that entire structure, then movements can, even when they win, even when they achieve their results, can still face the same repression. If we look at Egypt, we had a comrade who wrote us this year who had never been involved in politics before the uprisings. But now she said she saw that in the last 3 years in Egypt, they had 4 different governments, but the same police were still shooting at them. The nightmare version of this is in Ukraine, where the government has made a proposal to bring some of the self-organized nationalist and fascist militias who fought in the Euromaidan against the riot police, to bring them into the official police structure of the government to replace the riot police who were fired. So, thinking about what anarchism can offer to rebellions and riots around the world, one thing is this critique of the entire structure of policing, of any social system that requires that much force, that much coercion to hold it together. Because this is crucial for us to see, for us to explain in contexts where governments fall left and right, but policing continues. And many times, repression hits the hardest just after the powerful movement has started to die down. Another thing that anarchism can offer is the practical experience of resolving conflicts outside of the state. In our occupations, in our camps, in our autonomous zones and squats, in the experience that we have in figuring out how to stay safe without the police, how to resolve conflicts among ourselves. These are some of the questions and some of the skills that are needed in so many of these situations where, for the first time, people are experiencing self-organized lives outside of the violence of the police. And finally, anarchism can offer an exciting moment, an exciting ability to act right where the popular momentum of anger against the police brings larger and larger numbers, more and more power into the streets, at the same time that this popular anger temporarily, just for a moment, holds back the police from using the full extent of their force. This is something that happens earlier on in these rebellions, in many of these places, in Turkey, in Brazil. It can last for just a short time, sometimes just a single demonstration. But if we are organized, if we're ready, if we can step into this moment ready to escalate, to use different tactics, to take struggles to the next level, to expand the collective sense of what is possible to do inside of a struggle, then even a small group of people can totally change the context of how a social movement develops when we can find this particular point. So, policing, citizenship, and democracy. Let's talk about citizenship. So, in an era of constant crisis, with wars, poverty, famine, genocide, so many consequences of a brutal economy, there's constantly a population of people who are displaced, who are pulled up from the place where they live and forced to scatter around the world. And this population is a crucial part of what can keep capitalism functioning today. Back home where I live in the United States, there's somewhere between 12 and 20 million people who live inside the borders of the United States. But because they lack citizenship, because they don't have that piece of paper telling them that their life matters, they can be exploited to an extent that no one who has that citizenship can be. And without this group of people, without this vulnerability of a chunk of the population, the economy of the country where I live would collapse. It couldn't continue. And just as this process of displacement and migration is happening on the global level, that same process, the same dynamics, are happening on a local level as gentrification. Again, pulling people up from the place where they live, cutting the bonds that we have to our homes, to each other, to the places we live, and replacing those bonds with the top-down relationship of the state to the citizen. And the direction that this is headed is not pretty. If we look at Lagos, Nigeria, largest city in Western Africa, there's a new project being built by the government and some corporations from Europe called Eco Atlantic. Now, this development is going to create an island in the ocean off the coast of Nigeria. There's not an island there right now. They're building it from nothing. And on this island, there will be enough housing and enough jobs for 200,000 of the richest people in Nigeria. This island will be connected to the rest of the country by a single road. And you can bet that most people in Nigeria will not be allowed to drive on that road. Instead, 70% of the population in this city of millions and millions has no stable housing, no access to water or electricity. And this is the direction of development in the world today, where small zones of privilege for the rich are surrounded by wastelands of poverty. Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds like a fucking nightmare to me. This is obviously not a popular vision for the future of humanity and the economy. So, depending on the state and the history and political context, this type of extreme exploitation may not be possible everywhere. So, the state has to develop other strategies to keep this constant crisis of capitalism away. And one of the best strategies it has so far is nationalism. Now, this can take different forms. If we look at, Sweden or Switzerland, we have this wonderful model of social democracy where inside of the borders, inside of the bubble, we can have prosperity, equality, social justice, a nice life, so long as those borders are harsh enough, so long as that citizenship is restrictive enough to keep that crisis outside, to keep the exploitation between nations and the exploitation inside of them between citizens and not citizens secure enough. And this has worked to keep many of these countries stable for a long time. But in this era of global revolt, even these countries aren't safe. If you think about Sweden, not a country we usually associate with riots and rebellions. Last year in Stockholm, the largest riots that the country has seen in decades took place. And where did they begin? Among the immigrant communities of Stockholm. Among people excluded from the benefits of this social democracy compromise, who lacked the citizenship that to say that their life counts inside of this bubble. And so, if social democracy seems to be under pressure, not working to contain that crisis as well as it used to, what happens then? Well, in Sweden, during these revolts, beginning in the immigrant communities, the Swedish Fascist Party began to organize community patrols to fill in for what the police weren't doing, in their opinion, strongly enough. And this is the other side of the nationalist response, this solution to the crisis of capitalism. Of course, fascism. Now, we might think about social democracy and fascism as opposites, systems that are in conflict with each other. But both of them require strong borders that keep the exploitation quarantined to the rest of the world. Citizenships that divide whose life counts and whose life doesn't inside of the bubbles. And both of them are seen as solutions to the crisis that's broiling all around us. And so when social democracy seems to be failing, when austerity is cutting away at the benefits people expect inside of these bubbles as citizens, then what do we see growing and growing? All around Western Europe and Eastern Europe, even in countries with strong social democratic traditions, extreme right and fascist parties are growing, becoming more powerful. In Greece, the Golden Dawn responds to austerity with free food programs and attacks on migrants. In Sweden, again, 1 month ago, after the International Women's Day protests in Malmö, A group of demonstrators was attacked by neo-Nazis. One was almost killed. And one of the neo-Nazis who participated in this attack, a member of the Swedish Fascist Party, had recently returned from a trip to Ukraine, where he had met with members of the fascist Svoboda Party to learn about how that struggle had succeeded in a popular uprising to gain power and become part of a new government. So it's more important than ever before that we challenge any notion of nationalism, any notion of the state's right to determine whose life counts and whose life is not important. In this new era of social networks and social media, there are new, potentially utopian ideas of what citizenship could look like based on the internet, based on social media, ideas of digital citizenship, where all of us can participate and have a voice by virtue of being plugged in to the same system. And in some ways, these radically inclusive ideas of how citizenship could work seem like an exciting alternative to the exclusive forms of citizenship based in national states. But, like all terms of citizenship, this form channels all of that power, all of that legitimacy, through a single matrix, a single point of control, so that we can be mapped and surveilled and our lives controlled more than ever before, giving that power, giving that legitimacy to institutions outside of ourselves will never be a solution to these problems of nationalism and citizenship. So what can anarchism offer? First, of course, our critique of all borders, all states, all nations. Unlike nearly any of the other visions articulated in many of these rebellions, it becomes more important than ever to defy the right of any state to determine whose life matters, to define who can move and who can stay and who can work. And another thing that we can offer is this connection between the global process of displacement and migration created through this capitalist crisis and the local version of gentrification in our own neighborhoods just around the corner from us. These same processes of capitalism, of precarity, of neoliberalism, that same push to profit, that same desire to replace any relationships that we might have to each other and to our homes with the relationships of the market and citizenship. These are some of the most radical challenges and connections that anarchism can offer to the false solutions of nationalism inside of these revolts. So, policing, citizenship, and democracy? Well, wait a minute. Okay, policing, yeah, fuck the police. We're on the same page. And citizenship, yeah, we have some critiques. We're not into it. But what about democracy? I mean, isn't that what we're fighting for? Okay, maybe not. But okay, but what about these rebellions, you know? And aren't these uprisings happening around the world pro-democracy rebellions? Isn't that what people are fighting for? Well, actually, I'm not so sure. Let's be a little bit critical of this. We might be able to say that about the uprisings in Tunisia or Egypt, where people overthrew dictators. But then think about the uprisings in Brazil against President Dilma Rousseff and the Workers' Party. Think about Turkey against President Erdogan. Think about the Occupy movements in various countries. Think even about Ukraine and the struggle against Yanukovych. All of these rebellions happened against democratically elected regimes. So it seems clear that there's something more going on than simply a struggle for democracy. In fact, rejection of the political class, of political parties, of politicians, anger against anyone claiming to represent them seems to be one of the common links between many of these different struggles. And if we look at Egypt, Mubarak, the dictator, overthrown, democratic elections are held, Mohamed Morsi comes to power, and in less than a year, he's booted out as the protests continue and the army steps in. So it seems clear that we have to think beyond representative democracy to understand these revolts and why people are participating. Of course, anarchism can offer a critique of all representation. Fuck politicians, fuck political parties. This is a good place to start. It's a popular position around the world. A new way to think about what government could look like. So, okay, representative democracy. But what about direct democracy? Democracy from below. The idea that we can create general assemblies and workers' councils and neighborhood plenums and make decisions ourselves with everyone able to participate and give their voice. Is this what we're fighting for? Real democracy? Well, there seems to be some evidence for this inside of these revolts. In Spain, in the occupation of the plazas, one of the major groups was called Real Democracy Now. This language of direct democracy and consensus was very powerful in the Occupy movement, in the student strikes and neighborhood assemblies in Montreal, and of course most recently in Bosnia, where right now people are still meeting in self-organized plenums that appeared after the revolts, where people are drafting demands of the government and determining how to organize themselves and how to live their lives after the protests. So, is this what we're fighting for? Is this what these rebellions are about? Direct democracy? Well, maybe we should be a little bit critical of that too. Because while it's true that anarchism can also offer a set of tactics that we've used over many years of consensus decision-making and direct democracy in our collectives and small groups, perhaps it's just as important that we also bring a suspicion of democracy, even direct democracy. Why? Well, anarchism can offer a suspicion of any process that centralizes power in a single institution, even if that institution is open, participatory, directly democratic. Let me give an example. At home in the Occupy movement, anarchists who had many years of experience with making decisions by consensus were very influential in the early days of Occupy. we could contribute the skills that we had with direct democracy that for many people felt liberating, who had never participated in self-organized meetings and had never felt like their voice was an important part of a consensus. This model made a lot of sense when we were organizing in small groups with high levels of affinity. But then, when we began to use these models in broad social movements with thousands of people who had little in common other than a general desire to get rid of things that existed, a general sense of anger at politics and corporations, then what we found was that these same tools that we thought could help us create a freer world and feel more empowered in our decisions became limits to the struggles. Because whenever we rely on consensus, on a single political unity to determine what we have the ability to do, we create what you could call a consensus reality. The reality that is acceptable to the largest number of people. And since in these revolts, we see people from all different parts of society, so many different values, interests, tactics, desires. That consensus that's possible, the reality that everyone can imagine together, becomes more and more conservative, the broader the participation is. So, perhaps anarchism can also offer a critique of democracy, a willingness to act beyond democracy, to act autonomously, to recognize that we don't have to be unified. We don't need a single political unity, which requires some form of citizenship to determine who counts, even if it's only who shows up at the meeting. Instead, we can act in harmony, autonomous groups striving in the same direction, fighting with our own tactics and our own ways, but recognizing that we're part of a broad upheaval. And we can critique any system that concentrates this ability to act, this ability to do what we think will help move struggles along in a single institution, a single method, a single physical place. So, policing, citizenship, and democracy. These are, hopefully interesting, different concepts, but what is it that ties them together? What's the connection between these different lenses for thinking about these struggles? Well, I think that there's a connection that we can see between every person who comes into the streets to rebel, regardless of the context, regardless of the issues. Every person who participates in these rebellions realizes on some level that the systems of legitimacy, the systems that determine what we have a right to do, the systems that take power for themselves away from us, are no longer working. They're not providing us with what we need. So, one of the most radical contributions that anarchism can make to any of these struggles is the realization that legitimacy can only come from in ourselves, that it can only come from our relationships to each other and to the places where we live, from our own needs and desires, that any system outside of ourselves that attempts to determine what is legitimate for us, whether that be the state, whether that be citizenship, whether that be private property or the law or the church, or even democracy, whether in the national legislature or in the General Assembly. Any system outside of ourselves that takes this legitimacy, this right to act, away from us and concentrates it outside of ourselves is a system we have to fight. And this can connect us in powerful ways across many different lines in these struggles. If we look at policing, why is policing so necessary? Why is so much force needed? Because the governments and companies and other systems of power that use the police to defend them fear that the people no longer see them as legitimate. So in Brazil, when the protesters from the universities and from the middle class and from the favelas and the poorest parts of the cities join together in their shared anger against the violence of the police, even when they have different struggles, different desires, different visions for Brazil, what connects them is the realization that these systems outside of themselves that try to determine how they have the right to act, that determine what is legitimate, that these systems don't work, that these systems have to be refused. And so this summer, in July, when the World Cup comes to Brazil and protests fire up to an extent that we can only imagine, there's a foundation created by this shared recognition that these systems outside of ourselves cannot determine what is legitimate, that we can only determine that for ourselves together in the streets. Again, with citizenship. What is citizenship? A system of determining who is legitimate to move across a border, or to stay, or to work in a given place. When we refuse the right of any system outside of ourselves to determine that legitimacy for us, we have a foundation for a radical refusal of any form of citizenship that can be imposed on us, of any false solution of nationalism that can be proposed to put the crisis away from us. And we can see glimpses of this in some of these revolts. In Bosnia, for example, 2 months ago, in the city of Mostar, a city notorious for conflict along lines of nationality, the protesters, furious about years of privatization and huge unemployment and misery, poured into the streets, first to attack the city hall and burn it down in defiance of politicians, and then to attack the police station and burn it down in defiance of their violence. But what did they do next? They marched to the offices of the two largest nationalist political parties in the city and burned both of them down. Nothing could be clearer that we have this radical possibility of refusing all nations and all states, all efforts to divide us from above, and instead recognizing that we can find our power to act. We can redefine our legitimacy across these lines in our relationships to each other in the street. And finally, democracy. What is democracy? It's a system that tells us that legitimacy, our right to act, comes from the structure by which decisions are made. That's where legitimacy is. It's inside of a particular process that, even if we can participate in it, is still outside of ourselves. But when we participate in these struggles, the questions that we should be asking about what tactics to use, whether the strategies we're using are working or not. The questions that we should ask are not, is it legal? Is it constitutional? Is it nonviolent? Not even, is it democratic? Instead, the questions that we should ask are, does it work? Does it help us meet our needs? Does it help us feel powerful? Does it expand our sense of what is possible and our ability to act? So, if we look at Gezi Park in Istanbul, the night before the police were going to come to evict the park, the protesters knew that they had to find a plan, that in spite of all these odds, they had to think of some way to resist. But in the park, there were so many different groups: anti-capitalist Muslims, environmental protesters, anarchists and anti-authoritarians, Kurdish resistance fighters, people from so many different perspectives, tactics, desires. How could they make a consensus? How could they come together? Instead of concentrating in a single assembly, a single consensus, seven different assemblies were organized at different points in the park, so people could organize with the folks with whom they felt the most affinity, so that people could work in harmony in this shared desire to resist the police without having to constitute a single consensus, without taking their right to fight, their legitimacy, from a single unified body. In the end, the park was evicted. But the resistance that these groups were able to mount to the police went beyond what anyone could have imagined, crossed so many lines that couldn't have been crossed even weeks before, and laid a foundation for a resistance that is continuing to this day. So, in conclusion, there's one thing that we know for sure. This wave of revolts is not over yet. We don't know where, we don't know when, but it's certain that more and more uprisings are going to be happening. And we have to participate. We cannot stand aside. If we look at Ukraine, we know what can happen when our enemies are allowed to define the terms of a struggle, to set our sense of what is possible inside of an uprising. So, what can we do? Every time that we act in our daily lives, in our struggles every day, in our relationships with each other, every time that we act to undermine the legitimacy of any system outside of ourselves, every time that we insist that the power to act, that our legitimacy can only come from ourselves and from each other, then we are laying the foundation for the radical possibilities of whatever revolts and uprisings will come in the future.